Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. One of the hallmarks of the Trump administration has been to pressure European allies to spend more money on defense and spend that additional money on buying capability from the United States in the form of new capabilities like the F-35 Lightning II fighter, a program on which many of America's closest allies have been participating on for the past two decades. The RAND think tank recently released a report on the outlook for the Atlantic Alliance's air capabilities at the vanguard, European contributions to NATO's future combat air power. And joining us are three of the report's four authors, Dr. Annika Benendike, Gene Germanovich, and retired United States Air Force Brigadier General Bruce McClintock. Sarah Heintz also participated in the report in an intern capacity, but won't be joining us today. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Annika, you guys see a very upbeat future for European air power in large part because so many of the members of the alliance are acquiring the F-35, which is a really leap ahead fifth generation capability aircraft. Lockheed Martin is the prime contractor, but obviously supported by partner nations and industries worldwide. And over the longer term, there are a number of other nations. UK is leading a team with Sweden and Italy, for example, on the Tempest program, and France is joined by Germany and Spain on the SCAF effort. But talk to us sort of in a more strategic perspective on what are the key takeaways from your report?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to share with you today. So this report was prompted by the renewed focus within the alliance on defense and deterrence following Russia's 2014 aggression against Ukraine. And we felt that there had been a good amount of attention at RAND and elsewhere paid to the ground domain, but less so within the air domain. And particularly, we wanted to focus on NATO combat air power. This was prompted in a bit as well by the release in July 2018 of NATO's Joint Air Power Strategy, which offers a broad pathway forward for the development of allied air forces across NATO's core tasks. And so what we really wanted to ask was what the evolving capability and readiness of European air forces was to perform combat air missions across a high intensity theater conflict against a near peer adversary. And we came up with a few interesting findings doing through a series of discussions with subject matter experts, as well as research into individual European air forces, also a review of Russian open source literature on the topic. And what we found first and foremost was that the Russian political and military leadership is quite concerned about NATO's relative advantage in the air domain, and that this dynamic is likely to intensify over the next several years, as we see larger numbers of fifth generation fighters entering NATO's air inventories. There's been in the ground domain, there's been discussion about of Russia's relative advantage due to its rapidly deployable ground forces in regions close to Russia's borders, such as Baltic states or Poland. But in the air domain, it tells a little bit of a different picture. If you look at Russian strategy documents and statements, the depth and speed provided by NATO's advanced platforms and munitions could blunt Russia's ground advantage. And so this was sort of the crux of our interest in the topic. Although European air forces possess fleets that have relatively limited capabilities for the most demanding missions that we would see, particularly in the early phases of a high intensity conflict that would be of most concern to Russia, for example, The European allies we looked at in the report had about 1,900 combat aircraft as of the time of publication, fewer than 100 of which were fifth generation.
Right.
So it was predominantly sort of a fourth generation force that we were looking at. But with this investment we've seen, and by 2025, we'll have over 200 F-35 stationed in Europe. It's sort of a sea change, as you mentioned. It will fundamentally change the way that European air forces would be able to contribute to the opening phases of a conflict, particularly a high intensity conflict. One of the missions we looked at particularly was the suppression of enemy air defenses, or SEED. So this was, we looked particularly at how it would change some of the operational concepts and the ways in which European nations were able to really contribute at the vanguard. What we also found was that really emphasized the extent to which interoperability and integration among European fifth generation fighters would be important, as well as fourth generation fleets, and the extent to which we would really need to see exercises and training that would reinforce those synergistic relationships. And we can say a bit more about that during the course of today's discussion. Finally, just the readiness issue, which I think we'll address in more detail as well, which is that even as we see these significant investments in fifth generation capabilities, it really will be important to continue to maintain operationally relevant air forces through available aircraft, munitions, aircrew. And so investments there are required as well.
Bruce, over the past dozen or so years, as Annika mentioned, right, you guys looked at not only where Russian capabilities are going, but also how Russians are perceiving that capability. Talk to us a little bit about how the Russian capabilities are improving and the kind of strategies NATO needs to maximize that the notion of air power as a deterrent, right? I mean, that works when you understand how your adversary views you to maximize that impact.
Yes, certainly happy to. The first thing I would tell you is that our review told us that there were three recurrent themes in Russian analysis of Western campaigns and activities. So the Russians are very focused on the Allies' emergent and refined capabilities, specifically PGMs and EW, and the combination of depth and speed that NATO and the Allied forces typically bring to the fight, specifically with long-range strike capabilities and combat platforms, and also the distinct pattern of Western target prioritization. Those are three themes that emerged in our research. And a kind of a simple way to refer to that, at least for me, is they respond to force structures that are potent, practiced, and persistent. Yeah. So what have they done in response to that over the past really 20 plus years is they have done a lot to emulate their forces to match Western capabilities. They see that the use of short and long range PGM are important. And so they've adapted that and they've made their air defenses much more robust in a way that is not impenetrable, but certainly requires us to rethink how we approach combat operations.
And so what are the best approaches of marshaling that Western, or I should say that NATO advantage to continue deterring Russia?
So in the context of the research that we did here, and it goes back to the themes that we just talked about, making sure that our forces are perceived as being potent, which means that they're actually capable of striking the intended targets. Practiced is the term that I use to make sure that the Russians perceive, because they do pay attention to the fact that we're actually practicing our force structure. And that goes a lot to the interoperability piece that Gene and Annika can talk about a little bit more. And then there's a persistence that's important to the force structure too, that the Russians pay attention to. So doing all those things in concert, I would like to point out that our report indicated clearly that that doesn't mean that we suggest that everybody should have the most advanced fifth gen fighter. That's just not realistic from a budget perspective. On the contrary, our recommendations indicated that based on realistic budgets, it's more important to create an interoperable force that plays to the best advantages of fifth gen and other gen fighters.
It's interesting because the air policing mission has been a relatively limited number of airplanes, right? And so air power advocates have been talking about, you know, how do you get, better leverage of surveillance and reconnaissance grid and integrate that with a little bit more robust air power in terms of delivering that kind of more robust deterrence message, even though there are a lot of countries that are participating on that. Gene, Annika mentioned, right, the importance of fifth generation capability that's coming aboard. But as she also noted, there are 1,900 airplanes in Europe, and most of those, except for about 100 or so, are fourth-generation airplanes. You guys propose a division of labor between these forces. How do you do that, and what are the challenges to getting to that fully interoperable, integrated force that the alliance needs?
Yes, Vago. What we've observed is that the F-35 acquiring nations are going to be able to use the aircraft more in a revolutionary way than just a evolutionary way. What is envisioned is that the F-35 stealth will enable it to get within a close enough range of the integrated air defense systems that Bruce mentioned. And then it's somewhat unprecedented ability to sense the battlefield and develop a map of that battlefield will enable it to kind of play the quarterback role, if I can use that analogy. It would be able to strike the targets itself, although it doesn't actually carry as much ammunition as its fourth gen counterparts, or it can pass off the targets, the targeting information, that map, to other forces, fourth-gen aircraft, even naval and ground force aircraft. Now, that in theory is a neat design, but what is required is sufficient communications links between the fifth-gen and the fourth-gen aircraft, and they have to be secure because Russia will be trying to exploit that and jam it. It also requires enough long-range munitions so that those fourth-generation aircraft that are beyond the integrated air defense systems range can, handle the targets that are quite a ways away that the F-35 will pass off. These are some of the concepts that are being explored and increasingly exercised as more and more nations receive the F-35 in sufficient quantities to do this.
And for those people who are asking, right, the sponsor of this report was the U.S. government. It didn't come at all from Lockheed Martin or the other industrial partners on the F-35 program. Is there a challenge? And I put this to whoever wants to answer this. In each of these cases, as air forces modernize, they tend to shrink. And this is one of those times when a lot of our closest allies and partners, whether it's Belgium or Britain or Denmark, Italy and Norway, who are all F-35 partners, are acquiring the aircraft, but are shrinking their air forces. At some point, is there a danger that these air forces are getting too small? And I'm thinking about some of the Netherlands, I should have mentioned in there as well, also a very, very key and foundational F-35 partner. Canada is part of the program as well. Turkey was, but it no longer is. At some point, do you get too small? Because I know that was a challenge for every small nation, some of whom were trying to juggle NATO defense operations with participating, for example, in Mali, while also doing Syria and Afghanistan as well. I mean, at some point, is getting too small a problem, or is that not the right way to look at it?
I would say yes and no. So yes, because of course there is a point where you no longer can offer a credible combat capability. For example, we assessed the 13 nations in Europe within the alliance that have at least two squadrons. So we kind of had a, for analytic purposes at least, a cutoff there. But no, because I think that one of NATO's inherent advantages is that, in fact, it can bring all these capabilities together so that, you know, the sum can be greater than its parts. The command structure is in place. Exercises and training are almost always multinational in nature. As the F-35 comes up, every single pilot will go to initial schooling in the United States. And so these small detachments or squadrons can be integrated, you know, in a multinational fashion to achieve effects. And if you look at it from the point of view of, yes, you know, that country may have 32 or this country has 16, those are very small numbers, but from a NATO perspective, 200 by 2025 and upwards of 400 by 2030, if well integrated, can in fact be a powerful deterrent.
All right. Just to add to it, to reinforce Gene's point, it's too small to accomplish what? First of all, what's the mission that you're trying to accomplish? And there's value in just demonstrating an ability to accomplish a mission that has a deterrent effect in a competition space. And also to reinforce Gene's allied point, it's also about all domains. So it's not just about one Air Force, it's all the Air Force together, and then it's capabilities from all domains.
Readiness continues to be a challenge. You mentioned the importance of readiness for European nations. What's the right approach to improve capabilities, right? I mean, to get to that point where it's, as Bruce said, right? I mean, what the Russians respond to is a practiced, ready, a persistent force. What are some of the ways and new approaches that the alliance have to take when they're bringing aboard a revolutionary new capability and then trying to integrate it with the whole, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's a complex readiness challenge.
Right. I mean, we, you know, in our report, we looked at some of the readiness issues associated with existing fourth generation fleets, as well as with the F-35s. You know, there's the within the F-35 consortium, there's challenges associated with spare parts pooling, which have been discussed extensively, and the ALS system, which is currently being addressed. And a lot of the older fourth generation fleets as well, maintenance costs are quite high. I think one of the interesting things that we learned in our report was just looking at taking a deeper dive in some of the training programs. You know, for example, with the fifth generation pilots and air crew, you know, there's very rigorous training at the beginning of their careers at Luke Air Force Base, but it through our interviews, we learned it really can diverge once they return to their home air forces. And so, you know, it's going to be really important to do kind of regular combined training among NATO allies, and sort of predictable exercises that are built in, to ensure that the skills and the interoperability that these personnel developed at Luke will be stay fresh. And I think that particularly thinking about, as Gene alluded to, some of these concepts of operation involving both fourth and fifth generation platforms, and particularly practicing those under high intensity conditions.
Fago, if I may, I think
You may.
You know, in the context of COVID and threats to defense budgets, I think this is an area to really watch. We're fairly, as you said, optimistic about the general trajectory and about the acquisition of the number of airframes, notwithstanding that some of the nations have small totals. But it's the training, it's the focus on interoperability, it's the focus on some of the supporting technologies for the rest of the force that will be an area to watch whether, you know, these ministries of defense and ministries of finance can muster enough resources to keep that going and maximize the value of the platform over the coming years.
You took the question right out of my mouth, Dean. So I appreciate that very much. France, for example, has not been a fifth generation nation. Obviously, very, very potent and very capable air force, is now spearheading a program with Germany and Spain on SCAF. You have the United Kingdom working with Italy and Sweden to develop the Tempest airplane. What do these consortia need to remember as they're developing their programs to ensure interoperability, right? I mean, on the one hand, it's relatively simple, whereas on the other hand, it's also a challenge. Sort of more fundamental, because I know you guys mentioned that in the report. What do they need to bear in mind as they develop that?
I mean, I think one of the key things to think about is the extent to which these various systems are able to communicate with each other. I mean, we're already seeing that in terms of the communication between fifth generation platforms and their fourth generation counterparts. And so as we're looking forward at the, for example, the some of the sixth generation efforts, and how do those interact with other fleets? I think in the medium term, particularly looking at a strategic level, at French and German ambitions, they're really going to see a generation-long gap in their combat air capabilities as they bypass these fifth-generation capabilities. So, what does that mean for the sort of the next, between now and the 2040 timeframe? For example, the French has upgraded the Rafale in the near term, but are they then reliant on targeting and threat data from other European platforms that are able to operate, in the range of advanced surface to air missiles. We've seen a very prominent role played by France in previous NATO air operations. And, we hope that we'd be able to continue to see that leadership role between now and 2040. And so I think it's very important that there's conversations particularly between the United States, the UK and France and exercises in which we're trying to, all three air forces are seeking to enhance that communication and work around those issues, but certainly something to think about. And then if you look at Germany, Germany has sought to play more of a leadership role in European security, but given its lack of fifth generation aircraft, it's going to circumscribe their role. I think that's sort of a broader strategic question, and how do they in the years between now and 2040 allow them to sort of play the roles that they've committed to within the NATO context?
Bruce, maybe I'll put this question to you, right? I mean, the idea of the combat cloud, Denis Mercier, chief of the French Air Force, who went on to become Supreme Allied Commander Transformation, talked a lot about cloud combat. The French operationalized that to a degree in their Mali operation early on, and now there are exponents of it. And JADC2, the Joint All Domain Command and Control System and Advanced Battle Management, ABMS, are all sort of looking at how to have the network be the integrating function. To what extent are we seeing, from an alliance perspective, right, the U.S. is moving toward that future? Is the alliance moving to that future in an integrated manner as well, right? Because the sensor fusion abilities of the jet and then its strike capabilities really depend on leveraging that network at the end of the day. Is that foundational network going to be built on an alliance-wide basis to support this revolution?
So I guess I characterize the network or combat cloud concept as saying everybody's moving in the same direction, but it's more like they're on railroad tracks and not everybody's in the same place at the same time. But that doesn't mean that the JADC2 concept can't work. It's not as if every platform has to be able to talk to every platform. That's the ideal, but that's one that's been discussed for decades. Frankly, we're closer even in the US, but not there. So I would say, yes, it's an important component of the overall structure and integration. But having fifth gen fighters able to collect information from satellites, pass it to fourth gen fighters, onto other domain components, Gene mentioned naval components or even ground components, that's an important part of integrating the overall fight. But I wouldn't say that it's realistic to say everybody's going to be able to talk to everybody. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. What's interesting is, you know, Annika, I think you mentioned, right, the importance of French forces in terms of operations. And certainly French forces have been incredibly active, not just in Mali, but as well as in Syria, as well as in Afghanistan. And of course, Libya was the major operation as well. You guys sort of assessed, you know, who's on the list of most meaningful European air power nations, and how, you know, it's some of the smallest nations that have managed to bring to bear some significant capability at the end of the day. And I was sort of curious about that. Whoever wants to take that question, by the way.
You know, we've certainly looked at some of the largest air forces, the traditional players. I mean, the United Kingdom, as you know, which does maintain one of the higher rates overall of platform availability, and has invested heavily in fifth generation assets. On air power, you know, British scholars have noted that air power is likely to dominate any British contributions to future state-to-state conflicts. I mean, I think we mentioned France. Italy is certainly worth looking at, both because of their investment in fifth generation assets, but then also their role, sort of the industrial role, within the F-35 consortium. They have an airframe final assembly and checkout facility, the first in Europe. Uh-huh. They also support sustainment, so they're an important part of that global assets management plan that I mentioned earlier. They also, Italy has significant ambitions in training and exercises. They've invested in recently in new jet trainers and want to expand their national and international training programs through an international flight training school. So I think Italy is a good player to look at. You know, you mentioned some of the smaller air force as well. I think, you know, as we've seen in previous NATO conflicts, the Dutch and Danish air forces have played an outsized role. You know, we now have the Dutch, Danish, Norwegian, and Belgian air forces that have F-35 capabilities. And, you know, to respond to your question earlier about smaller air forces, I think we're going to see stronger levels of collaboration among those smaller air forces and sort of thinking through how we can continue to have them punch above their weight as they have in previous conflicts.
And of course, I think many of the people in our audience probably know this, but the U.S. Air Force, Royal Air Force, and French Air Force have created a tripartite agreement to develop air concepts and exchange ideas on a very, very regular basis, knowing that these three air forces, as a general rule, will be together on almost 99% of all future operations. Gene, go ahead, because I know you want to add something before we break.
Yeah, another dimension in terms of who to watch, I would say, are the Italians and the Brits, and to a lesser extent, the Spanish, because of their naval aviation capabilities. Of course, one of the variants that the Europeans are buying is the F-35 Bravo, and the ability to bring sort of an air base from the sea, not only for maritime specific missions, but also in support of that counter IADS or counter ground campaign will be important.
And Bruce, any last thoughts before we part?
I just add, you know, I know that Gene and Annika have given a couple of specific countries and they're spot on those specific identifications. I just remind your listeners that it's also about thinking of this in terms of capabilities rather than countries. Because different countries, no matter how small they are, and even no matter how small their air forces are, bring important capabilities to the table in other domains. We're focused a little bit on air platforms here for understandable reasons.
What are some of those additional capabilities that they bring to bear that make them important, even if it's not on the combat air asset side of things?
So I'll start with domains in terms of other important capabilities. There's a significant need for cyber capabilities that select NATO allies provide at relatively high levels. And then there's also significant benefit from space capabilities that there are a few select allies that are advancing. And those do flow into the JAD C2 dimension, what used to be called multi-domain operations. Just to remember that an F-35 in and of itself is not going to be able to defeat a high-end adversary. It needs the other components and the other domains working in concert.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it, and would love to have you guys back on to talk about air power as well as European security issues. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure, Vago. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.